All right. Chairman Brad Holton, I'll bring the meeting to order. On the agenda, there is a, there's two 2 o'clock start times. The first one is for fiscal year 2025 budget workshops, number two. The three on the juvenile detention probation and misdemeanor probation have been canceled for today. And so we're going to be doing fiscal year 2025 budget workshop number two for the clerk. So, that point of clarification, clerk, yes. Take it away.
All right. Well, thank you. This is round two. There's a memo. There's a couple exhibits, additional handouts. I have it on the screen. I'm kind of taking a cue from the sheriff. It kind of provided a sheet that just kind of showed all the moving pieces, and it's also acceptable to our office to kind of just take away what the net movement might be one way or another and then make the changes in power plan on the record. I have this broken down. The auditor budget is the first item in the memo. And I had spoken to this maybe a couple days ago and about doing something with the chief deputy position. So I think where I'm at right now, and after visiting with Jess this morning to discuss this, the first step that I think is cleanest, that makes the most sense, is to keep the PCN for the chief deputy as is, but unfund it or defund the position. That is a total with salaries and benefits, that would be a reduction of $178,569.62 from what was in the first round in the auditor's budget. Jumping down to court clerk, I should have probably stacked those on top of each other. I just did them in the order in which the items were initially listed. What I'm requesting is an increase of a gross amount of $14,518.55. And the line 41380, which is for new reclass positions, and that's to cover a $12,000 salary increase for Jess Uresti, who's my designated senior deputy. He would remain in his current PCN, and this would be step up slash specialty pay. It would be a $12,000 net salary increase with the $14,518 reflecting what the gross amount would be as a change in the court clerk family. What that does to the auditor budget, the total reduction in the auditor's budget would be $441,138.62. Now, mind you, a big chunk of that, of course, is reflecting the unfunding of the PCN for chief deputy, but we also moved indigent out as their own group, county assistants. So they're their own division. Again, just as a reminder to note that change. I had mentioned earlier the possibility of moving the PCN into the court clerk, moving Jess into that PCN, and then vacating the court supervisor PCN, which would be unfunded. And I think the first step that I prefer to do is this as a cleaner version, as Jess would primarily be supervising the court clerk. He does an amazing job and don't want to create what would even be perceived as a vacancy. That being said, I am going to start directing him with some other duties. And the senior deputy, yes, statute requires it. I've named him as such, but I want to start utilizing him increasingly more with some additive responsibilities, mostly in organizational supervision, personnel management, process management, with the other divisions that are under my care as I kind of farm him out. So that's... and that would be a step that he would take, and then we could revisit within the fiscal year or the next fiscal year whether it makes more sense for a potential reorg change to then fill the chief deputy PCN. And if he were vacating the court supervisor, court clerk supervisor, PCN, rather than leave that vacant, I think that's the concern I have, is the perception that it's a vacated position. Even though as the chief, if he were the chief deputy, if we went that route, I think people would perceive him still functioning in that capacity. He would be officed over there, continue to be officed over there, because I don't have office space to add another staff. That I think this is just the progression. The next best step is to do it kind of as I recommend here. And then if Jess were in the future to step into the PCN for chief deputy, then there would be a succession plan for someone else or clerk supervisor. That my preference would be to have that transition at a future time rather than leave that position vacated. I think not having the chief deputy position, that PCN filled, would not create as much potential anxiety or perception issues as opposed to vacating the court clerk supervisor, if that makes sense.
Yep.
Any questions on those two? I think it covers kind of the one and three.
Yep, it does.
And there's an update there. Jess did a good job, and the original budget was going to be $74,000 and change less. With this increase going in, it would be $60,000 and change less. So it's still a year-over-year decrease in the court clerk. The county assistants, so item number two, I had already spoken to the supervisor previously in the first round, requesting an adjustment for the supervisor. This updated request, you'll notice highlighted in that bullet point with the yellow, there's an additional amount requested for the two PCNs that are mentioned. There's an exhibit, the second page, that has this. Upon further review of how many years of employment these two employees have, one is slightly below the mid, and one is just slightly above the mid, like within a dollar. And employees at 18 and 19 years, approaching 19 and 20 years, should, I believe, should be higher in their grade. So this is what I'm calling an equity adjustment. Just some background. There had been back and forth discussion. Yvonne's done a good job talking to HR about whether or not their grade is assigned correctly as a 12, whether it should be a 13 or potentially a 14. HR has given good feedback. They do feel some reluctance about regrading it higher than the 12, but they did say their time in their grade would potentially merit the adjustment that's reflected in this request. So I know that this is new. This was not in the first round. I would ask that you'd be gracious enough to at least allow this consideration to go into the compensation workshop meeting that we will have in the future. I know that these are a couple more that would be added to that list, that spreadsheet, as you explore the time and grade. So,
is that okay? I'm good with it.
Yeah, I'm good with it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Yep, let's do it.
All right. So, kind of wrapping up, elections. As you know, elections falls under current expense and consolidated. First off, after reviewing, I tried to put a lot of move a lot into the consolidated in the first round, and Haley did a good job. We reviewed that. I realized after reviewing it some more, if we were to fully expend the consolidated budget, we would exhaust our fund balance and be in the negative. I don't think we would fully expend the full budget. We haven't. That being said, consolidated election is state monies that come in. Those monies go into that dedicated fund that's restricted for use within election. I do want to use that fund to maximize its use of state funding for election needs. And that being said, there is an adjustment in here to move a little bit of money, well, a chunk of money out of consolidated into current expense. A $76,000 transition for service contracts from consolidated election to current expense elections. So that gives consolidated elections more space. Let's see if I have consolidated election up really quick here. So you'll notice here, consolidated elections, I have it up on the screen. This was the original handout. I increased the consolidated election budget by $236,000 and change in the first go-around. The fund balance, I think, currently is slightly below that. That was the cause for concern. So by removing $75,000 out, I think it's thin with consolidated election, but I think we can get through the year with what's in the fund balance and what the state revenues would be to meet the needs in consolidated. But this does mean a $76,000 increase that's moving over to the current expense side on that item. In the first round, I had $25,000 earmarked set aside for new reclass positions. I had asked for more time to try to bring more clarity, specificity to that dollar amount. So in this second round on the record in the memo, you'll note that there is an adjustment for requested for the PCN 746, our office manager. There, in HR, the prior HR business partner that I was working with had noted that there, and I know she's present, Haley's present, can speak more to it, but there is in the ADP, a note of a change in employment class in 2019, but the same title is used as just the general election specialist. I know Yvonne's been around too for most of this time over the years, but in 2019, as I understand it, the prior manager, supervisor, whatever you want to call that title, had, I don't know, retired, resigned, fired, separated. Haley was identified in 2019 to be the de facto manager in the elections office who answered to the clerk and deputy clerk. And so when reviewing with HR about whether or not how to understand her time and grade, there was another adjustment in 2023 that puts her in her current title with her current grade. But I think there's a good case to be made that her time and grade should, the clock should run 2019, not 2023, as she was doing essentially the same task with the same responsibilities back to 2019. So when you start the clock in 2019, it changes how much time and grade she's had. And there's also been increasing responsibilities within the elections office. And the we've also added an employee within elections office. So there's more oversight. There's more full workers. There's more oversight. So the request in here is essentially taking kind of a 60% in grade based on the anticipation of 6 years in service and running those calculations. And so you'll see that net and gross increase that's requested. So that would be $7,106.73. That would be more specific for that employee. And then if you're gracious enough, I reduced $25,000 to the $7,110,000. Is still a net reduction. The $10,000 is not tied specifically to a PCN. I would like, and I don't think this, unless we were to adopt this as the normal policy process to allow some discretionary amounts of money to be appropriated over the fiscal year, I don't think that should be the norm, and I'm not requesting that be the norm, but in this case, since it's taking me some time to better understand the history in the elections office, what the grades are for the job titles and stuff, I do want just that very modest amount to potentially appropriate in the current in the next fiscal year. Of course, you would review that; it would be vetted by you. You would have to sign off on any potential adjustments. But what I don't want is to have more time in my current position. Realize that there are some things that should have been advocated for in this short window that I just, because of time and experience, don't have the full information. So what this would do is it would reduce that $25,000 amount to $17,106. The other big chunk, which is also the other attachment, we kept the $300,000 line item in for capital needs, and I'm comfortable reducing that amount to $200,000, which is a $100,000 reduction based on the worksheet that Haley provided that you I'm pulling up here. And this really deals with continuing to order print-on-demand units. We still have some budgetary capacity in the current fiscal year to put an order in. And then in FY25, the challenge will be to get the order in FY25 where we get the units ahead of the November 5th election. And of course, early voting is gonna start 2 weeks prior to that. We might try to push the full order in the current fiscal year. If there's, I know there's budget savings from the A to just fund the total budget request so that we can have one bulk order and know for sure that it's in time, but it would hit FY24, in which case FY25 would be even less than the 200,000, but I'm just trying to phase that out. See in the spreadsheet. There is possibility of trading the duos in for trade-in credit. That information is just provided because I think Commissioner Van Beek was maybe a little curious about how exactly that would work or look. So I'm just kind of putting on the record what information we have. Of course, it's subject to change due to, you know, fluctuations and changes in pricing and policy. And I am not putting in here necessarily a request to trade in the units. I think that I would want that to be a resolution, not a unilateral decision made by the clerk's office, because, you know, these are significant assets that we spend a lot of money on. So if we were to trade them in based on a depreciation value and kind of re-up the depreciation schedule with new units, it kind of resets that 10 to 15 year lifespan essentially of the units. We have the potential to do some trade-in of the duos. As you see here, this is getting into a little bit of operational detail, but I don't know, Haley, if you want to kind of describe what you feel is an ideal amount to try to retain in the duo stock. It's reflected in the worksheet.
Yeah, if we move forward with trading in the duos, my suggestion would be 6 per location, which would require that we hold 300 in our inventory, and then I suggest 25 for a contingency in case some are out in repair or we need to add some additional units. That would leave us 80 that could be converted to either a print-on-demand unit or a precinct scanner, depending on how we see those. And so to convert a duo to a precinct scanner is $2,900. To convert a duo to a print-on-demand, which includes the scanner gun, which allows them to just scan that barcode and ensure that it's the accurate ballot they're issuing, is $2,600.
And to be clear, this is a hypothetical scenario. We're not, just I want to be clear on the record, we are not requesting permission here to complete. It's just to provide the information, but that is kind of a back pocket option where we could procure some print-on-demand units without necessarily having to expend money. It would be negotiating a trade and maybe only netting the difference in cost if, you know, depending on how many units relative to what we were trading in. But right now the plan is to retain our full duo stock and try to price out what it would cost to get print-on-demand fully deployed over all of our polling locations. We do need to, you know, think through the duo stock moving forward. We did have a meeting last night with a lot of our chief judges. Haley, you can speak to it more. I've heard in the past there's always, you know, some complaints, a couple duos acting sticky, this and that. But once that topic came up, there was quite a bit of confirmation throughout that room that, especially with some of the experienced chief judges, that the duos were acting up a little bit more this year over last year. Now, sometimes you can get mob mentality where you see things based on what, you know, kind of a leading, you know, statement, but it seems, I have no reason to doubt what the experience is. What's important is when there's a unit that's acting finicky that we know fully and so that we can identify that unit and work with HART. But just so you know, any servicing of units is incurring a cost too with HART. It's not like there's a 10-year warranty that covers all maintenance costs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's also limitations. Haley, you can speak to it. There's some limited cleaning and maintenance that we're able to perform, but there's certain things that we're not allowed to disassemble and do certain things.
Right. The unit. We can kind of clean the laser heads and the rollers and all of that, but that's as far as we can go in to that machine to troubleshoot.
And the problem with the duos were, I think, mostly feeding the paper in. That's what a lot of people were describing. It was acting finicky. And I know that there is some printed out. I don't know if that's part of the duo challenges, is sometimes the sheets would be maybe slightly blurry or not. But I also realize if someone's pulling on it, Haley, it when rather than let it spit it out, that they're going to create that blur. So the challenge is, how much is it hardware error, human error? I'm going
to
have...
We'll try and use one hand to put the paper in the duo, and then it'll go in a little sideways and cause a paper jam. So sometimes it can be user error versus issues with the machines.
What's interesting is when I asked, has anyone experienced similar issues with the scanner? No one... I mean, there's a very quantifiable difference between the experience with the duo saying that that acts finicky sometimes and how you feed it. But the scanner, when you complete your voting, you know, put your paper ballot through the scanner, there's very few reports, if any, of that being finicky and acting up as far as taking the paper ballot. So it's just, my request right now isn't to make a wholesale decision about the duos. I just want to keep you apprised of stuff we're hearing from the users, our chief judges, who, you know, see them being used at all of our locations, and what our obligation is to maintain the units and deal with them. But the print on demand, we didn't have. There were some issues about maybe the scanner gun. Some didn't know the scanner gun was maybe in the box with the. And weren't deploying that, and other things that we're going to have to address better in deploying those units in November, so the chief judges and all the poll workers know exactly how to use the print-on-demand units. Alongside the duo, the only challenge with the hybrid is you have two different types of units that are being managed at each poll location. It adds slightly to the complexity. The advantage is the scanner, though, can take both ballot styles, so that no matter what type of paper ballot, whether it's the duo or the print-on-demand, is going through the same scanner and captured that way. But this reduction from 300 to 200,000 actually more than covers what the worksheet indicates. It leaves a little bit of contingency, which I'd like, for potential procurement of other needs that we may need. I want to speak briefly to ranked choice voting. There's been some questions and concerns about the initiative as it's on the ballot this November and what we would need to do logistically to accommodate ranked choice voting if it was passed. Based on a meeting with Hart tomorrow, but I had a phone call with them and discussed with them actually on two occasions, what we would need to do as far as the ranked choice voting piece, and they do recommend that we would need a dedicated computer. And that would be the only additional piece of hardware that we would need to add. The Hart scanner, the tabulator, what goes onto the V drive, all of the information is there to conduct the ranked choice voting. But the additional question is what you use for the tabulator of ranked choice voting. Hart does not, they don't seem interested to want to get into that business of handling the tabulator because there's so many different logical instructions that you can give through the tabulation on how you transfer votes and whether or not the ballot gets exhausted if your second choice candidate's already eliminated, or you skip over that and go to your third choice who might still be active, or whether the ballot gets exhausted and if the person's, and that's another discussion as far as how the transferability of votes occurs in the tabulation. All they say is there is a third party open shareware who handles the ranked choice tabulating, and that's Hart is kind of washing their hands of handling the tabulation piece, but did recommend you'd need another computer to do the tabulation separate from how the other information is being captured. That being said, that's assuming that we would have to tabulate a ranked choice election based on a county race or a city race. The legislature, I believe right now, and their legislation says that you're not allowed to have ranked choice elections for local races. Much of the talk in November is about having ranked choice voting for the statewide office holders. in that case, the tabulation would not be occurring. I just want to be clear. We would not be doing the tabulating, the algorithm, applying the algorithm and transferring the votes at the county level. It would have to be done Secretary of State's office or central, because they would be pulling all the data off the V drive. And because your facility is a statewide race, so someone who's last place in our county might not be the last place statewide, if that makes sense. We're not like reporting what our county winner is. You're just saying this is how people voted, and the state would have to take all the ballots through the entire state and do a central tabulation with the ranked choice algorithm being applied. I don't know what costs the state would incur in having to facilitate that tabulation and whatnot, but as far as I understand now, we would take our V-Drive data and send it to the state, and the state would run the ranked choice tabulation because it would be a statewide race.
So theoretically, if the municipality or some other political subdivision chooses to have that type of voting and the legislature opens the door for that,
We do, and I would turn to legal to better understand and see like what the voter initiative does and how that would conflict with existing legislation that prohibits ranked choice voting at the local level, or at the county level. So I think we're kind of in a wait and see approach, but part of the $200,000 is to cover, I think, the identifiable costs for finishing our print on demand order, but also leave a little bit of contingency because there's a partial unknown about what obligations we would have to try to facilitate the ranked choice voting. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
How much was the print on demand used? And I'm assuming it was used fairly significantly if you're wanting to get more of them?
Well, hit and miss. I do not have that report here. I could provide that report to you offline. It was most used in Wilder. That location had, as far as percent.
Surprise.
I think Wilder led in the percent usage. There's other locations where it was not used very much. But what I can't tell you is how informed the voters knew. I didn't want to fatigue the election judges with going above and beyond and saying, you know, we have this or this. Would you like me to explain to you how this works or whatnot? So I think some of them probably defaulted in using the duos as the default and kind of put the onus on the voter to say, I would like to do the print on demand. I think others are, how would you like to vote? There's two options. And so I think going into November, that's another coaching, teaching element on our part. And Claire, we're not trying to push one or over the other, but yeah, there is a marked difference between some precinct use and others. But you also have to keep in mind, even if the print on demand was 1/5 of the ballots cast in that precinct, in a lot of locations you might have had 6 duos and 1 print on demand. Or I don't know what the average duo is deployed, about
6 or 8 to 1
ratio. So you really need to do a proportionate. So like in Wilder, I want to say like 40%, I think, of the ballots were the print on demand. I don't know how many duos were in Wilder. Do you remember?
Wilder, I believe we sent 6.
So there you have the print on demand obviously outperforming the duos when it comes to a, you know, number of ballots per unit sort of analysis or proportionate analysis. And the costs are essentially the same. The other concern is how quickly you can, the ballots can be printed about 1 every 40 seconds. 40 to 60 seconds in our test, but that's assuming you're nonstop ready to just click print on the next queue. So there is, you know, logistically, the duos also, you have to feed it and have it print back out. But yeah, we do have that data. There's a big difference among some of the precincts. There's a lot of members of the public who appreciated having that option for what it's worth. I know that's giving some feedback. And Wilder, obviously, they seem to like it because that outperformed. We probably could have had 4 duos and 1 print on demand and still been okay, maybe there. Or another thing moving forward is to maybe look at what the preference is each precinct and try to deploy based on what seems to be the preferences within those precincts.
Thank you.
Did you, I won't ask Commissioner Brooks how you voted, but.
You could ask him theoretically how he voted.
or you know.
I don't even know if print on demand was available at my precinct.
Oh, yeah.
I don't have a problem using the electric pencil.
Yeah.
Personally, so. I can touch the screen and then read to make sure the printout matches the way I voted.
You're doing exactly what a alert voter should be doing.
Thank you. So is there any concern, though? I mean, these are expensive, that if we were to go through and make the purchase, that are these going to get utilized, you know, to offset the cost?
That's a good question. I mean, the part of it is a transition and bringing some assets into our election inventory that kind of resets the depreciation schedule. And there's also other good reasons to have the print-on-demand unit at each location. If the duos are acting up, and Haley can speak to this because of the way the daisy chain works, I know it was maybe, what, a couple hours? Was it Bethel Nazarene in November where they were down? And
yeah.
I came over and said, I think maybe you're going to try to deploy a print-on-demand or one of our,
yeah,
possibly as a backup.
Yeah, right before they got back up.
Because we only had one or two, but part of the challenge is if there is, and I'm not anticipating those problems, but just from a contingency standpoint, the print-on-demand also provides a little bit of security if the duos are down because they're all connected. And something's not working right, you can keep people voting with the print-on-demand option and kind of vice versa. But it does add a secondary piece as far as for our election staff. And that was good feedback last night, too, is that we need to train. And there is more anxiety that's being created when you add another element into the way in which people can vote and the protocols for each. But whether they're going to be utilized, I think what would be fair is if, you know, the print-on-demand, I think we would need to do that assessment and really look at it based on a proportional basis. If you have six duos and one print-on-demand, is it getting about 1/7 use? If it is, then it's the same as a duo, essentially, right? But then you're also giving those people, they're happier because they actually have that option, otherwise they wouldn't. If it's less than 1/7, then that's probably a sign that, you know, it's not used in the same proportion as a duo. If it's more than 1/7, then it's actually outperforming the duo when it comes to sort of just pure efficiency, how many voters per unit are choosing that. So if we did one print-on-demand unit each, and we do need to make a big decision about the duos, you know, in the future years to figure out what to do. I know Ada County says they plan on their future to be all print-on-demand at some point. I don't know how quickly they're going to get to that. They still order a lot of printed ballots, and they have print-on-demand, but they're increasing their reliance on print-on-demand year by year as the way of generating and producing ballots. And part of that is to eliminate the logistics of having lots of different ballot stock. Mm-hmm. And the concern in the industry, at least the people I talk to seem trustworthy, a lot of the human error that occurs in elections is handing out the wrong ballot for those who rely on the paper ballot stock.
My own wife got the wrong one once.
and people can still get the wrong ballot potentially, but I mean, it's mostly error-proof, mostly. There are still ways in which you can assign the wrong ballot in the system, but if a voter is already registered and you scan, get that out, there's a control. It's possible that we've assigned that voter to the wrong split, in which case that's an error on our office, not coding the person to the right district. But that would not be a hardware error on the part of that. But you have a human error every time a ballot's being handed. If multiple types of ballot styles, you got to make sure that the right ballot's handed out. But, you know, all that to say, I think the industry is moving more and more to print-on-demand. That's not the reason we should, necessarily move in that direction. The duo is very helpful because it does create a controlled ballot. I'll just be fair and on the record state the concern I have with hand-marked ballots. We're always going to have them with absentees. Absentees are going to be hand-marked. till some other technology occurs where adaptive technology is sent with the ballot where people are voting at home. But when voters are hand marking a ballot, it's possible for them to mark it in ways that the scanner might not pick up. So, for example, in the audit that we had, there was one undervote for Fulcher because there was a dot in the box. The scanner didn't pick up that dot, but the Secretary of State's audit, they felt that that should have been a vote counting for Fulcher. But that's just an example. The nightmare scenario is if someone circles the box or circles the name or underlines the name and there is no mark within the box. But you hope that the voters follow the instructions that are very clearly articulated that you need to fill in the box. And there's actually a picture of filling in the box. But and most people, that's how they voted. But and you know, in this case, in the audit, there was one dot out of, you know, the 5,000 ballots they looked at, and that dot, the scanner did not count that as a vote for Fulcher, but voter intent was discerned because they consistently used a dot throughout. In which case, if you hypothetically were to take that out, if someone were to use a dot throughout, the scanner would kick out if they detected that something's in there and said, there's a mark, it may or may not count, and you have an opportunity to either complete filling it in or spoil the ballot if it was an inadvertent mark. If it picked up nothing, I think we had it set, there's different defaults. If you have a multi-page ballot, if it's blank, it'll spit it back out and say, there's nothing marked. Are you sure you want to cast this ballot, like, blank? So it is alerting, or it'll also alert if one side's blank, just one side. You could also do a default. We didn't use this default, and Hart says there is the option, and they had a client use it once and never use it again because it slowed down voting so much, is if there's a single undervote. So if there's 12 things on your ballot and you left one thing blank, it would spit it out and call an alert saying there's an undervote. Are you sure you want to cast your ballot without marking this? I feel the default we use if one side's blank, to have that as sort of a default measure, because there's some people who might not know there's a page two on the back and be like, oh shoot, I didn't think of turning the ballot over. It's hard to imagine that someone might not think of looking on the other side, but it happens. And they say, well, why didn't someone tell me or whatnot? So again, in the training, it's just to emphasize, if we know we have a multi-page ballot, maybe we try to, you know, remind people to have that prompt. Just make sure you examine your whole ballot. On the duos, you don't have that issue of skipping over. So it's forcing you, right, to click all the way through to the end to complete the task. So there's pros and cons, you know, of the ballot types.
Moving.
Recorder's office, remain as is. The only other thing, briefly, that's not on this paperwork, we've interviewed some very good applicants for the GIS position. For elections, I'm really encouraged by some of the applicants that we've interviewed. I think we're getting close to wanting to do a hire. That being said, I might have alluded to this prior, but right now these budgets are built with the GIS position being funded in the elections budget, current expense. Right now the plan would be to transfer that PCN into IT. Out of the elections office.
Okay.
It would be cost neutral.
It
would just be shifting from current expense elections to current expense IT. With an understanding that the person would be mostly dedicated to election needs as a top priority. But if there's downtime or they check off some of the tasks that we have, IT could better deploy them to other tasks. And I know maybe IT can speak better to it. I think that there's some efforts maybe in the sheriff's office to utilize GIS. I don't know if Chief Rass speak to it more.
Yeah, Mr. Clark, there's other duties that the GIS administrator actually does in IT, which is weed and pest, and some other entities that don't have full-time GIS. You'd supplement that. Okay. So this is a win-win.
Okay. It's an efficiency thing. Good. Good.
And also, yeah, better utilize their subject matter expertise.
Yeah.
You know, they're compensated to be a subject matter expert in a certain field, and I think the best stewardship from accounting's perspective is make sure that they're using that. And if they check, if they handle all the election stuff, they can use their skill set for other needs in the county. If they were in the elections office and they were done with all their GIS work, the concern I have is we'd be asking them to do other duties as assigned that wouldn't maybe be really tied to GIS. And so maybe someone would be a good sport about that, or someone would be like, hey, I came here to do GIS work. I can tell you of the applicants that we've interviewed, I mean, like, one, the most recent applicant, they love GIS. All they want to do is GIS. Like, GIS is all they want to do. Like, so it's like, you know, that's almost confirmation that moving into IT and making sure that they're just doing GIS-related tasks. Obviously, we're not going to tell them, hey, do some GIS work for Weed and Pest when they're an elections employee. Like, it just wouldn't make sense. It would make more sense in the IT. So that's just more a heads up. But if that were to occur and we were to hire someone and move that PCN over, the IT budget would go up. And the current expense elections budget would go down by that one position.
Okay.
That covers everything I have to say. Of course, you know me, I can talk forever, but
self-realization is the first step, clerk.
Amen. Amen.
And my staff, Yvonne, did you have? Yes, we move that into community support. We know that we're still getting information about the community or the guardian ad litem cost, but yeah, right now we move that into, as I stated, I think in an earlier meeting, we moved it over to community support. So we're trying to zero out public defense to not cause confusion, because the legislature is saying that they are completely taking it over. Which, as we know, there's some items that we're still sorting out on whether the cost falls to us. But the guardian ad litem right now, Yvonne is scheduling a meeting with a lot of stakeholders to try to be prepared come October 1st with how exactly we process and administer to find legal counsel on behalf of that need. Because I can tell you right now, we're not prepared. The county's not prepared.
State's not.
States we're not prepared, and we got to figure that out, and that would come back before you, especially because my guess is we're probably going to have some sort of MOU or negotiate terms with some sort of local legal counsel who will agree to take the guardian ad litem with some sort of compensation rate per hour that's mutually agreeable. We're not Ada County. I'm a little jealous. I asked Clerk Triple over there. They have lots of firms doing pro bono work. If there's pro bono work of competent people that want to do this work here in Canyon County, I'm not aware of those opportunities. But we could try to find those opportunities as well. But we did put, was it $300,000? And again, the state is supposed to reimburse. And as Seth Griggs stated, he feels that the statute says that they shall reimburse, but we also know that they have a finite amount of reimbursement money of $500,000 for the fiscal year. That's part of a contention. He feels that just because they run out of their money, he still reads that shall reimburse as obligatory on the state. But right now, we have to be prepared to incur that cost, possibly. We were also adding, I don't know if Kyle, Sarah, if you can confirm, we were going to add an offsetting revenue line into the Community Guardian reflecting the potential of the reimbursement for some of the cost.
Okay.
I do believe that's set at 150.
Yeah. Yeah, a little more modest than the 300,000 we anticipate potentially incurring. We will see. I think everyone's going to see, as Chief Rouse said, the state's also... This is new transition for them, so it's kind of new for everyone. And I think everyone's going to have a lot of lessons learned, I think, the first few months, the first year into it, and we'll have to reevaluate how this relationship works. I know Commissioner Brooks has some opinions that he's refraining from. His body language suggests he has thoughts. I will not tempt them out.
As Chairman Holton says, filter on.
Filter on.
Mr. Chair, as long as we keep the revenue lines active in the public defense budget so we can recapture some of that money, it would be nice. as we bill the state for some of these other ancillary costs.
That prompts another item. I know this is under public defense. Just briefly, we did meet with I. Bailey to do just some preliminary scheduling, calendaring, logistics. It seems like maybe it's more than a preference. I think Kyle will look into it. Sarah will look into it, bring a recommendation. But you know that payout for the down to 40 hours vacation time? That payout might need to hit FY24, our current fiscal year, because technically their last day of employment is in the current fiscal year. And from like an accrual budgeting standpoint, that liability is incurred in sort of billed, as it were, I guess, on the last day of 24. You're nodding. I don't know if I'm saying it.
No,
you want to articulate it better?
I believe that's probably going to be the case.
Yeah, because, Mr. Chair, everything I've read is their last day of employment of the county is 9:30, and the first employment day of the state is 10-1, specifically dated that way. So we're going to have to incur that cost in 24.
Yeah.
That's how I've read it and interpreted
yeah.
it and heard it.
We'll have more on that. We might have to include that in a budget amendment if that payout, depending on what that amount is, exceeds what the budget capacity is. If they have enough A savings to pay out and they're under their public defense budget, then we're fine. If it's in excess, we'll have to amend the budget and put that on the record.
Yeah, we'll get ready to amend the budget.
Notice a lot of vacation hours coming out of public defense this month, so hopefully
we're working away at it. But the 40 hours is still, they may never even get down to the 40 hours. That's the heck of it. Well, do you have any good news?
He had some,
but he ended on a really sour note for me. So
good news is we trimmed. You know.
Yes. I agree.
That's too fast. See something like this.
Ms. John, I'm hesitant to say this.
It's just recorded forever.
The potential duties of a chief deputy or assigned role to take on those duties, I think what's being proposed is light. I think the $14,518 to put on this position, because what I'm doing is comparing the responsibilities of that director of court operations plus these other duties. Then you compare that to what the current interim TCA is getting paid and the responsibility in that role. It's just me saying this out loud. I think that's a little light. I think that should be a little bit further adjusted up.
Let the record indicate that Chief Rass believes when we do our compensation workshop that the number I came up with needs more scrutiny.
Has that been reviewed by HR?
No.
Okay.
And the intent was to get something on paper on the record here to move to the compensation workshop.
Okay.
If you would be so kind to attempt to see if HR could review that.
Yes, I
okay.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for listening to me.
Good. All right. What else?
Good job digging in.
Yep, good job. All right.
I'm good to move it on to the next step, Mr. Chairman.
On forward? Okay. Let the record show that we're in concurrence to move on forward what was presented, and we'll get to workshop 3 or whatever it's going to need to be next.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, that's that. Let's adjourn for the moment. Thanks.